Hi, this is Mrs. English. Thank you for joining me again for another read aloud from John Milton's Paradise Lost. I will be reading from Book 2. First, the argument. The consultation began. Satan debates whether another battle to be hazarded for the recovery of heaven. Some advise it, others dissuade. A third proposal is preferred, mentioned before by Satan, to search the truth of that prophecy or tradition in heaven concerning another world and another kind of creature equal or not much inferior to themselves about this time to be created. Their doubt, who shall be sent on this difficult search? Satan, their chief, undertakes alone the voyage, is honored and applauded. The council thus ended, the rest betake them several ways and to several employments, as their inclinations lead them, to entertain the time till Satan return. He passes on his journey to hell gates, finds them shut, and who sat there to guard them, by whom at length they are opened, and discover to him the great gulf between hell and heaven. With what difficulty he passes through, directed by chaos, the power of that place, to the sight of this new world which he sought. Line 1. High on a throne of royal state, which far outshone the wealth of Ormus and Ind. So we're comparing Satan to some type of an oriental despot. Or where the gorgeous East, with richest hand, showers on her king's barbaric pearl and gold, Satan exalted sat, by merit raised. Remember, they are in conclave, they are in council. The rest of the evil spirits are in pandemonium, and they have shrunk, but Satan and his council are in this conclave that was mentioned at the end of Book 1. Line 5 again. Satan exalted sat, by merit raised to that bad eminence, and from despair thus high uplifted beyond hope, aspires beyond thus high, insatiate to pursue vain war with heaven, and by success untaught, his proud imaginations thus displayed. And now we prepare, line 11, Satan has a formal speech. This is another epic convention, and you can see by the quotation marks on line 11 that Satan prepares his speech here. Powers and dominions, deities of heaven, for since no deep within her gulf can hold immortal vigor, though oppressed and fallen, I give not heaven for lost. From this descent, celestial virtues rising will appear more glorious and more dread than from no fall, and trust themselves to fear no second fate. Me, though just right, and the fixed laws of heaven, did first create your leader. Next, free choice. With what besides, in council or in fight, hath been achieved of merit, yet this loss, thus far at least recovered, hath much more established in a safe, unenvied throne, yielded with full consent. The happier state, line 25, in heaven, which follows dignity, might draw envy from each inferior, but who here will envy whom the highest place exposes foremost to stand against the thunderer's aim? And here the thunderer, of course, is God. This is an epithet. Rather than saying God, they're calling him the thunderer, which is metaphorically probably comparing God with Zeus, a thunderer who is in charge of the weather and who sends lightning bolts crashing down. And of course that imagery is going to come up here in a little bit. So the thunderer's aim, line 28, foremost to stand against the thunderer's aim, your bulwark, and condemns to greatest share of endless pain, where there is then no good for which to strive, no strife can grow up there from faction, for none sure will claim in hell precedence, none whose portion is so small of present pain that with ambitious mind will covet more. With this advantage, then, to union, and firm faith, and firm accord, more than can be in heaven, we now return to claim our just inheritance of old. Surer to prosper than prosperity could have assured us, and by what best way, this line 40, whether, of open war or covert guile we now debate. Who can advise may speak. So Satan has just opened the floor for debate, and his suggestion is, shall we go to open war, or shall we go to covert guile, trickery? How will we try to win back our spot? He ceased, and next to him, Molech, sceptered king, stood up, the strongest and the fiercest spirit that fought in heaven, now fiercer by despair. His trust was with the Eternal to be deemed equal in strength. All right, what had Molech hoped? His trust was with the Eternal to be deemed equal in strength. He had hoped to be equal in strength to the Eternal Thunderer, to God. And rather than be less, cared not to be at all. With that care lost, went all his fear. All right, if he can't be as much as God, if he has to be less, he doesn't care if he is at all. With that care lost, went all his fear of God, or hell, or worse, he recked not. And these words thereafter spake. Line 51. This is another formal speech, and Molech stands up, and he's going to speak first. My sentence is for open war. Of wiles more unexpert I boast not. Let them those contrive who need, or when they need, not now. For while they sit contriving, shall the rest, millions that stand in arms, line 55, and longing, wait the signal to ascend, sit lingering here, heaven's fugitives, and for their dwelling place accept this dark, opprobrious den of shame, the prison of his tyranny who reigns by our delay. No, let us rather choose, armed with hell flames and fury, all at once, o'er heaven's high towers, to force resistless way, turning our tortures into horrid arms against the torturer. When to meet the noise, line 65, of his almighty engine, he shall hear infernal thunder, and for lightning see black fire and horror shot with equal rage among his angels, and his throne itself mixed with Tartary and sulfur. All right, Tartarus is the terrible place in classical mythology. That is where Tantalus is punished. Tantalus is the man who stands chest deep in water. He's very thirsty and he's very hungry, and when he bends over to drink from the water recedes. When he reaches out to pick the fruit from the tree, the branch goes just beyond his reach. He's being tortured in Tartarus. And so it's an especially bad type of hell, a place in the afterlife, in the underworld, for those whom the gods are very angry at, and they were very angry at Tantalus. And so when he says they're going to take the things from hell and take them up and attack heaven with those things, mixed with Tartarian sulfur. Of course, sulfur is like lighting a match. It's the part that really stinks. And so they're going to throw all of these awful things from hell at God, at the Thunderer. Mixed with Tartarian sulfur and strange fire, his own invented torments. But perhaps the way seems difficult and steep to scale with upright wing against a higher foe. Let such bethink them if the sleepy drench of that forgetful lake benumb not still. And of course, they're talking about the forgetful lake in line 74, is reminiscent of Lethe, which is the lake of forgetfulness. When you go to the underworld, you drink from that and forget. That in our proper motion we ascend up to our native seat. Descent and fall to us is adverse. Who but felt of late when the fierce foe hung on our broken rear, insulting and pursued us through the deep, with what compulsion and laborious flight we sunk thus low? The ascent is easy then. The event is feared. Should we again provoke our stronger, some worse way his wrath may find to our destruction. If there be in hell fear to be worse destroyed, what can be worse than to dwell here, driven out from bliss, condemned in this abhorrent deep to utter woe, where pain of unextinguishable fire must exercise us without hope of end, the vassals of his anger, when the scourge inexorably in the torturing hour calls us to penance? More destroyed than thus, we should be quite abolished and expire. What fear we then? So Molech says, I say open war, we go and attack them. What on earth could he, what not on earth, what in hell could he do to us that would be worse than this, perhaps extinguish us, and that's okay with him. What doubt we to incense, lines 95, his utmost ire, which to the height enraged will either quite consume us and reduce to nothing this essential, happier far than miserable to have eternal being, and if our substance be indeed divine and cannot cease to be, we are at worst on this side nothing, and by proof we feel our power sufficient to disturb his heaven and with perpetual inroads to alarm. And so what he says in line 99, if our substance be indeed divine, so Moloch is thinking, maybe we cannot be killed. Continuing on, line 104. Though inaccessible his fatal throne, which if not victory is yet revenge, line 105. And so even if they can't have victory, they could have revenge. He ended frowning, and his look denounced desperate revenge and battle dangerous to less than gods. On the other side, uprose Belial, in act more graceful and humane, a fairer person lost, not heaven. Ah, and so he was beautiful. A fairer person lost, not heaven. Line 110. He seemed for dignity composed and high exploit, but all was false and hollow. Though his tongue dropped manna and could make the worse appear the better reason to perplex and dash maturest counsels, for his thoughts were low, line 115, to vice industrious, but to nobler deeds timorous and slothful. Yet he pleased the ear, and with persuasive accent thus began. And guess what? Here on line 119 we have Belial's formal speech. This is an epic convention. They all make formal speeches. Each one takes his turn. And here Belial makes his speech. I should be much for open war, O peers, and not behind in hate, if what was urged, main reason to persuade immediate war, did not dissuade me most, and seemed to cast ominous conjecture on the whole success. When he who most excels in fact of arms, in what he counsels and in what excels mistrustful, grounds his courage on despair and utter dissolution, as the scope of all his aim after some dire revenge. First, what revenge? The towers of heaven are filled with armed watch that render all access impregnable. All right, line 131. Belial says, I would listen to Moloch if he didn't say he doesn't even care if he's destroyed forever. And what kind of revenge could we get anyway? There's an armed watch at heaven's towers. It's impregnable. You can't get to it. Line 131. Impregnable. Oft on the bordering deep encamp their legions, or with obscure wings scout far and wide into the realm of night, scorning surprise. Or, could we break our way by force, and at our heels all hell should rise with blackest insurrection, to confound heaven's purest light? Yet our great enemy, all incorruptible, would on his throne sit unpolluted, and the ethereal mold, the pure fire, incapable of stain, would soon expel her mischief and purge off the baser fire victorious. Thus repulsed, our final hope is flat despair. We must exasperate the almighty victor to spend all his rage. All right, who is the almighty victor? That is God. It's another epithet to God. And so here Belial argues that why would they even try to attack for revenge? They certainly will not even get near to God, who will sit on his throne, and they may exasperate him to spend all his rage. Line 145. And that must end us. That must be our cure, to be no more. Sad cure, for who would lose, though full of pain, this intellectual being, those thoughts that wander through eternity, to perish rather, swallowed up and lost in the wide womb of uncreated night. Line 150. Devoid of sense and motion? And who knows? Let this be good, whether our angry foe can give it or will ever. How he can is doubtful, that he never will is sure. Will he, so wise, let loose at once his ire, belike, through impotence or unaware, to give his enemies their wish and end them in his anger? Do you really think that he doesn't know we would rather not exist than to exist in hell? So do you really think he'll give us what we wish? That's what he's saying. And in them in his anger, whom his anger saves to punish endless? Wherefore cease we then? Say they who counsel war, line 160, we are decreed, reserved, and destined to eternal woe. Whatever doing, what can we suffer more? What can we suffer worse? Is this then worst, thus sitting, thus consulting, thus in arms? Line 165. What when we fled amain, pursued, and struck with heaven's afflicting thunder, and besought the deep to shelter us? This hell then seemed a refuge from those wounds, or when we lay chained on the burning lake. That sure was worse. Line 170. What if the breath that kindled those grim fires, awaked, should blow them into sevenfold rage and plunge us into the flames? All right. Belial says, what if God got angry and made the flames seven times as hot? Or from above, should intermitted vengeance arm again his red hand to red right hand to plague us? What if all her stores were opened, and this firmament of hell should spout her cataracts of fire, independent horrors, threatening hideous fall one day upon our heads, while we, perhaps, designing or exhorting glorious war, line 180, caught in a fiery tempest, shall be hurled each on his rock, transfixed, the sport and prey of racking whirlwinds, or forever sunk upon yon boiling ocean, wrapped in chains, there to converse with everlasting groans. Line 185. Unrespited, unpitied, unreprieved, ages of hopeless end, this would be worse. War, therefore, open or concealed, alike my voice dissuades, for what can force or guile with him, or who deceive his mind, whose eye views all things at one view? How can you get away with anything with a God who sees all? He from heaven's height, line 190, all these our motions vain sees and derides, not more almighty to resist our might than wise to frustrate all our plots and wiles. Shall we then live thus vile, the race of heaven thus trampled, thus expelled to suffer here chains and these torments? Better these than worse, by my advice, since fate inevitable subdues us and omnipotent decree the victor's will. To suffer as to do, line 200, our strength is equal, nor the law unjust that so ordains. This was at first resolved, if we were wise against so great a foe contending, and so doubtful what might fall. I laugh when those who are at the spear are bold and venturous. If that fail them, shrink and fear what yet they know must follow, to endure exile or ignominy, or bonds or pain, the sentence of their conqueror. This is now our doom, which if we can sustain and bear, our supreme foe, there's another epithet for God, the supreme foe, line 210, our supreme foe in time may much remit his anger, and perhaps, thus far removed, not mind us not offending, satisfied with what is punished, whence these raging fires will slacken. If his breath stir not their flames, our purer essence then will overcome their nauseous vapor, or inured not feel, or changed at length and to the place conformed in temper and in nature, will receive familiar the fierce heat. Maybe we'll get used to the heat if we're here long enough. Maybe it's not so bad. And so what he says in line 210, our supreme foe in time may much remit his anger, Belial says, maybe if we bear our punishment well, maybe God will soften his anger. Or maybe we'll get used to the pain. They'll get conformed to it. Line 218. In temper and in nature, we'll receive familiar the fierce heat and void of pain. This horror will grow mild, this darkness light. Besides, what hope the never-ending flight of future days may bring? What chance, what change worth waiting, since our present lot appears for happy, though but ill not worst, if we procure not to ourselves more woe? Line 225, Belial advises, let's not make more trouble for ourselves. Line 226, Thus Belial, with words clothed in reason's garb, counseled in noble ease and peaceful sloth, not peace. And after him thus Mammon spake. All right, now Mammon is going to speak, line 239. Either to disenthrone the king of heaven we war, if war be best, or to regain our own right lost. Him to unthrone we then may hope when everlasting fate shall yield to fickle chance, and chaos judge the strife. The former vain to hope argues as vain the latter. For what place can be for us within heaven's bound, unless heaven's Lord Supreme, that's God, we overpower? Line 237. Suppose he should relent and publish grace to all. What if he forgave us? On promise made of new subjection. What if he forgave us if we promised that we would be subject to him again? With what eyes could we stand in his presence humble, line 240, and receive strict laws imposed, to celebrate his throne with warbled hymns, and to his Godhead sing forced hallelujahs, while he lordly sits our envied sovereign, and his altar breathes ambrosial orders and ambrosial flowers, line 245. And so Mammon is reminding them, what on earth do you think you want to do? Do you really think we can overpower God? Do you really want to go and get his forgiveness? Do you really want to serve him again? Line 246. And his altar breathes ambrosial odors, line 245, and ambrosial flowers, our servile offerings. These are the things they'll put before God. This must be our task in heaven. This our delight. How wearisome eternity so spent in worship paid to whom we hate. Let us not then pursue by force impossible, by leave obtained unacceptable, though in heaven our state of splendid vassalage, but rather seek our own good from ourselves, and from our own live to ourselves, though in this vast recess free, and to none accountable, preferring hard liberty before the easy yoke of servile pomp. So Belial suggests, let's just accept our situation, look to ourselves, and get used to it. Our greatness will appear then most conspicuous when great things of small, useful of hurtful, prosperous of adverse, line 260, we can create, and in what place soever, thrive under evil and work ease out of pain. Through labor and endurance, this deep world of darkness do we dread? How oft amidst thick clouds and dark doth heaven's all-ruling sire choose to reside, his glory unobscured. Line 265, the all-ruling sire, of course, this is God. How oft amidst thick clouds and dark doth heaven's all-ruling sire choose to reside, his glory unobscured, and with the majesty of darkness round covers his throne, from whence deep thunders roar, mustering their rage, and heaven resembles hell. As he our darkness, cannot we his light imitate when we please? This desert soil wants not her hidden luster, gems and gold. All right, this is the original King James, use of the word want. You can replace this word with lack. Line 271, 270 and 271. This desert soil lacks not her hidden luster, gems and gold. What is Mammon, the god of? Okay, money. Gems and gold. Nor want we skill or art from whence to raise magnificence. And what can heaven show more? Our torments also may in length of time become our elements. These piercing fires are soft as now severe. Our temper changed into their temper, which must needs remove the sensible of pain. All right. This place will not seem so bad once we get used to it. All things invite to peaceful counsels, and the settled state of order, how in safety best we may compose our present evils, with regard of what we are and where, dismissing quite all thoughts of war. Yet ye have what I advise. He scarce had finished, when such murmur filled the assembly, line 285, and now we have a Homeric simile. All right, he scarce had finished, when such murmur filled the assembly, and what was that murmur like? As when hollow rocks retained the sound of blustering winds which all night long had roused the sea, now with hoarse cadence lull seafaring men o'erwatched, whose bark by chance or pinnace anchors in a craggy bay after the tempest. Such applause was heard, as Mammon ended, and his sentence pleased, advising peace, for such another field they dreaded worse than hell. All right, they like the idea of hell. They dread anything that could be worse than this. So much the fear of thunder and the sword of Michael wrought still within them, and no less desire to found this nether empire, which might rise by policy in long process of time, in emulation opposite to heaven. All right, they like this idea of trying to make this a better place, and they are afraid of Michael. Which then Beelzebub perceived, than whom, Satan except, none higher sat. Line 300. With grave aspect he rose, and in his rising seemed a pillar of state. All right, we've already had three of the big bad guys plus Satan speak, and now Beelzebub will rise up. And in his rising seemed a pillar of state, deep on his front in graven deliberation sat, and public care, and princely counsel in his face yet shone, majestic though in ruin, sage he stood, with Atlantean shoulders fit to bear the weight of mightiest monarchies. What are Atlantean shoulders? Atlantean, that's an adjective formed from the name of Atlas. Atlas was the Greek god who held the world on his shoulders, and so it implies strength. With Atlantean shoulders fit to bear the weight of mightiest monarchies, his look drew audience and attention, still as night or summer's noontide air. While thus he spake, line 310, and now we have Beelzebub's speech. Thrones and imperial powers, offspring of heaven, ethereal virtues, or these titles now must we renounce, and changing style be called princes of hell? For so the popular vote inclines, here to continue and build up here a growing empire, doubtless while we dream, line 315, and know not that the king of heaven hath doomed this place our dungeon, not our safe retreat, beyond his potent arm to live exempt from heaven's high jurisdiction, in new league banded against his throne, but to remain in strictest bondage, though thus far removed, under the inevitable curb reserved his captive multitude, for he, be sure, in height or depth, still first and last will reign sole king, and of his kingdom lose no part by our revolt, but over hell extend his empire, and with iron scepter rule us here, as with his golden those in heaven. What sit we then projecting peace and war? War hath determined us, and foiled with loss, line 330, irreparable. Terms of peace yet none vouchsafed or sought, for what peace will be given to us enslaved, but custody severe, and stripes, whipping, and arbitrary punishment inflicted? And what peace can we return, line 335, but to our power hostility and hate, untamed reluctance and revenge, though slow, yet ever plotting, how the conqueror least may reap his conquest, and may least rejoice in doing what we most in suffering feel. Nor will occasion want, lack, nor shall we need with dangerous expedition to invade heaven, whose high walls fear no assault or siege, or ambush from the deep. What if we find some easier enterprise? Line 345. There is a place, if ancient and prophetic fame in heaven err not, another world, the happy seat of some new race called man, about this time to be created like us, though less in power and excellence, but favored more of him who rules above. So was his will pronounced among the gods, and by an oath that shook heaven's whole circumference, confirmed. Thither let us bend all our thoughts, to learn what creatures there inhabit, of what mold or substance, how endued, and what their power, and where their weakness, how attempted best by force or subtlety. Though heaven be shut, and heaven's high arbitrator sit secure in his own strength, Of course, this is God, heaven's high arbitrator, line 360, sit secure in his own strength. This place may lie exposed, the utmost border of his kingdom, left to their defense who hold it. Here, perhaps, some advantageous act may be achieved by sudden onset, either with hellfire to waste his whole creation, or, line 365, or possess all as our own, and drive as we were driven, the puny habitants, or if not drive, seduce them to our party. All right, so Beelzebub is counseling. He has heard, rumored, that God has created a new place, created a new creature called man, and he says, let's go see if we can either drive them out by war or by trickery. Let's find out what their strengths are, their weaknesses. Maybe we can drive them out like we were driven out. And then in line 369, or seduce them to our party, that their God, line 369 now, that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works, line 370. And of course, that's what will happen. And Milton's audience knows this. This recalls Genesis 6:7, when God is sorry that he made man and is going to destroy him. And that is, of course, what they're hoping. They're hoping to ruin the new creation, man, so that their God may prove their foe, and with repenting hand abolish his own works. Line 370. This would surpass common revenge, and interrupt his joy in our confusion, and our joy upraise in his disturbance, when his darling sons, hurled headlong to partake with us, shall curse their frail original, and faded bliss faded so soon. So they want to ruin man so that God will cast them down into hell with these angels, cursing God. Line 376. Advise if this be worth attempting, or to sit in darkness here, hatching vain empires. Thus Beelzebub pleaded his devilish counsel, first devised by Satan, line 380, and in part proposed, for whence but from the author of all ill could spring so deep a malice, to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell to mingle and involve, done all to spite the great Creator. Line 385. But their spite still serves his glory to augment. The bold design pleased highly those infernal states, and joy sparkled in all their eyes. With full assent they vote, whereat his speech he thus renews. All right. So they are in full assent of Beelzebub, and so Beelzebub continues speaking, line 390. Well have ye judged, well ended long debate, Synod of Gods, and like to what ye are, great things resolved, which from the lowest deep will once more lift us up, in spite of fate, nearer our ancient seat, perhaps in view of those bright confines, whence with neighboring arms and opportune excursion we may chance re-enter heaven, or else in some mild zone dwell not unvisited of heaven's fair light secure. All right, maybe they can get closer to heaven. And at the brightening orient beam purge off this gloom, the soft, delicious air, to heal the scar of these corrosive fires, shall breathe her balm. If they can just get a little closer to heaven, perhaps from earth, maybe they can smell some of that air and feel some of that healing, healing air. And then he continues in line 402. But first, whom shall we send in search of this new world? Whom shall we find sufficient? Who shall tempt with wandering feet the dark, unbottomed, infinite abyss, and through the palpable obscure find out his uncouth way, or spread his airy flight, upborne with indefatigable wings, over the vast abrupt, ere he arrive the happy isle? What strength, what art can then suffice, or what evasion bear him safe through the strict sentries and stations thick of angels watching round? Here he had need all circumspection, and we now no less choice in our suffrage, for on whom we send, the weight of all and our last hope relies. Line 416. This said, he sat. So Beelzebub sits down, and expectation held his look suspense. So they're waiting to see who will go and find out for us. his look suspense, awaiting who appeared to second or oppose or undertake the perilous attempt. But all sat mute. Line 420. Pondering the danger with deep thoughts, and each in other's countenance read his own dismay, astonished. None among the choice and prime of those heaven-warring champions could be found so hardy as to proffer or accept alone the dreadful voyage, till at last Satan, who now transcended glory, raised above his fellows with monarchal pride, conscious of highest worth, unmoved, thus spake. O progeny of heaven! So this is Satan speaking again. Line 430. O progeny of heaven! Imperial thrones, with reason hath deep silence and demure seized us, though undismayed. Long is the way, and hard, that out of hell leads up to light. Our prison strong, this huge convex of fire, outrageous to devour, immures us round ninefold, and gates of burning adamant barred over us, prohibit all egress. These past, if any pass, the void profound of unessential night receives him next, wide gaping, and with utter loss of being, threatens him plunged in that abortive gulf. If hence he scape into whatever world or unknown region, what remains him less than unknown dangers and as hard escape? But I should ill become this throne, O peers, line 445, and this imperial sovereignty, adorned with splendor, armed with power, if aught proposed and judged of public moment, in the shape of difficulty or danger, could deter me, line 450, from attempting. Wherefore do I assume these royalties, and not refuse to reign, refusing to accept as great a share of hazard as of honor, due alike to him who reigns, and so much to him due of hazard more, as he above the rest, line 455, that as he above the rest high honored sits. Go therefore, mighty powers, terror of heaven, though fallen, intend at home, while here shall be our home, what best may ease the present misery, and render hell more tolerable, if there be cure or charm to respite or deceive, or slack the pain of this ill mansion. Intermit no watch against a wakeful foe, while I abroad through all the coasts of dark destruction seek deliverance for us all. Line 465. This enterprise none shall partake with me. Thus saying, rose the monarch, and prevented all reply, prudent lest from his resolution raised others among the chief might offer now, certain to be refused, what erst they feared. And so refused might in opinion stand his rivals, winning cheap the high repute which he through hazard huge must earn. But they dreaded not more the adventure than his voice forbidding, and at once with him they rose. Their rising all at once was as the sound of thunder heard remote. Towards him they bend with awful reverence prone, and as a god extol him equal to the highest in heaven. Line 480. Nor failed they to express how much they praised that for the general safety he despised his own. For neither do the spirits damned lose all their virtue, lest bad men should boast their specious deeds on earth, which glory excites, or close ambition varnished over with zeal. Line 485. Thus they, their doubtful consultations dark, ended rejoicing in their matchless chief. And here we have another Homeric simile, line 488. As when from mountain tops the dusky clouds ascending, while the north wind sleeps o'erspread heaven's cheerful face, the lowering element scowls o'er the darkened landscape snow or shower, if chance the radiant sun with farewell sweet extend his evening beam, the fields revive, the birds their notes renew, and bleating herds attest their joy that hill and valley rings. Line 495. O shame to men! Devil with devil damned firm concord holds. Men only disagree of creatures rational, though under hope of heavenly grace, and God proclaiming peace, yet live in hatred, enmity, and strife among themselves, and levy cruel wars, wasting the earth, each other to destroy. All right. As if, which might induce us to accord, man had not hellish foes enough, besides, that day and night for his destruction wait. The Stygian Council, line 506, and Stygian, this is an adjective formed from the Styx. The Styx was a river in the underworld, a horrible river that if the gods swore by that, they could never revoke what they had promised to do. They were held to it. The Stygian Council thus dissolved, and forth in order came the grand infernal peers, midst came their mighty paramount, and seemed alone the antagonist of heaven. And of course their mighty paramount is Satan, nor less than hell's dread emperor with pomp supreme, line 510. And godlike imitated state, him round a globe of fiery seraphim enclosed with bright emblazonry and horrent arms. Then of their session ended, they bid cry with trumpets' regal sound the great result. Line 515. So they're going to have trumpets tell the great result to everyone else. Toward the four winds, four speedy cherubim put to their mouths the sounding alchemy. By herald's voice explained, the hollow abyss heard far and wide, and all the host of hell, with deafening shout, returned them loud acclaim. Line 520. Hence more at ease their minds, and somewhat raised by false presumptuous hope, the ranged powers disband, and wandering, each his several way pursues, as inclination or sad choice leads him perplexed, where he may likeliest find truce to his restless thoughts, and entertain the irksome hours till his great chief return. Part on the plain, or in the air sublime, upon the wing, or in swift race contend. As, and this is another Homeric simile, as at the Olympian games, or the Pythian fields, and of course the Pythian refers to the Delphian games, which are just like the Olympic games were the games at Olympus, and the Pythian games were the games at Delphi, where the Pythian priestess presided. Part curb their fiery steeds, or shun the goal with rapid wheels, or fronted brigades form, as, and another simile, as when to warn proud cities war appears waged in the troubled skies, and armies rush to battle in the clouds, before each van pricked forth the airy knights and couch their spears, till thickest legions close with feats of arms, from either end of heaven the welkin burns, the vault of heaven. These similes are telling us that what the chief angels are doing during the absence of Satan is they are conducting games. They're going off to find things that will help them to get past their restless thoughts, their worries, and of course their pain and suffering. And it's just like when people are participating in these Olympian or the Delphic games and doing things to entertain themselves. That's what they're doing while Satan is gone. Then, line 539. Others, with vast Typhian rage, more fell, rend up both rocks and hills, and ride the air in whirlwind. Hell scarce holds the wild uproar. All right, this is what they're doing. Some of them are going crazy, riding the air, doing all types of things while they're down there. As, and this is another Homeric simile, line 542, as when Alcides, that is Heracles, from Ocalia, crowned with conquest, felt the envenomed robe. This is the robe that Alcmene, his wife, gave him. Envenomed means that it was soaked in the venom of a dying centaur, and when Alcmene gave this to her husband Heracles, he put it on, and this caused him so much pain that he requested to die. He built a funeral pyre and burned himself, and then he got to go and live in Olympus and be a hero in the afterlife. So it's just like when Alcides, when Heracles crowned, after being crowned with conquest, felt the envenomed robe and tore through pain up by the roots, Thessalian pines, those big trees, and Lycus from the top of Etta threw into the Euboic Sea. Others, more mild, retreated in a silent valley, singing with notes angelical to many a harp their own heroic deeds and hapless fall by doom of battle, and complain that fate, free virtue, should enthrall to force or chance. So some of the fallen angels are spending their time singing about heroic deeds. This is very similar to the Iliad when Achilles refuses to fight because he has been dishonored. He sits in his tent and plays the lyre and sings of the heroic deeds of others since he cannot be out fighting and doing his own heroic deeds. Line 5, 5, 1. Free virtue should enthrall to force or chance. Their song was partial, but the harmony, what could it less when spirits immortal sing, suspended hell, and took with ravishment the thronging audience. In discourse, this is conversation, more sweet, line 5, 5, 5, for eloquence the soul, song charms the sense. Others sat on a hill retired, in thoughts more elevate, and reasoned high. And the things they're going to be reasoning here in the next few lines, they are contemplating free will. This is what they're thinking about. Some are off doing athletic games, some are ripping up the town, and some are sitting apart contemplating things. They're more elevated, higher thoughts. They're contemplating things. And Milton had written an essay called Christian Doctrine. On Christian Doctrine, you'll see it abbreviated in your text as CD. And if there is a footnote here to go to the back and read an essay, you might want to read that section from On Christian Doctrine that they have. And they will tell you, they'll give you a little bit of the information as far as what Milton felt about free will. Continuing in the text, 5, 5, 7 again. Others apart sat on a hill retired, in thoughts more elevate, and reasoned high of providence, foreknowledge, will, and fate. Fixed fate, free will, foreknowledge absolute, and found no end in wandering mazes lost. Of good and evil, much they argued then, of happiness and final misery, passion and apathy, and glory and shame, vain wisdom all, and false philosophy. Yet with a pleasing sorcery could charm pain for a while or anguish and excite fallacious hope, or arm the obdured breast with stubborn patience as with triple steel. Another part, so these are some others of the angels in line 570, other squadrons of angels, they're going to go and see if there's any place better than where they're at, because they can only distract themselves for a short time and then they are feeling their pain again. Line 570. Another part in squadrons and gross bands on bold adventure to discover wide that dismal world, if any clime perhaps might yield them easier habitation, bend four ways their flying march along the banks of four infernal rivers that disgorge into the burning lake their baleful streams. Abhorred Styx, the flood of deadly hate. This is the river Styx of the underworld. Sad Acheron of sorrow black and deep. Cocytus, named of lamentation loud, heard on the ruleful stream, fierce Phlegthon, whose waves of torrent fire inflame with rage, far off from these, a slow and silent stream, Lethe, this is the river of forgetfulness in the underworld, Lethe, the river of oblivion, rolls her watery labyrinth, whereof who drinks, forthwith his former state and being, forgets, line 585. Forgets both joy and grief, pleasure and pain. Beyond this flood, a frozen continent lies dark and wild, beat with perpetual storms of whirlwind and dire hail, which on firm land thaws not, but gathers heap and ruin, seams of ancient pile, all else deep snow and ice, a gulf profound as that Serbonian bog betwixt Diamata and Mount Cassius old, where armies whole have sunk. The parching air burns frore, and cold performs the effect of fire, line 595. Hither by harpy-footed furies hailed, and of course the harpies are the furies. The furies are these classical, from the time of the Greeks and the Romans, classical goddesses
that are hideous. They are have the body of a bird and the head of a female, and their job is to chase and torment those who have killed parents or committed awful crimes. That's their purpose in life. Thither by harpy-footed furies hailed, at certain revolutions all the damned are brought, and feel by turns the bitter change of fierce extremes, extremes by chance more fierce, from beds of raging fire to starve in ice, line 600. Their soft ethereal warmth, and there to pine immovable, infixed and frozen round, periods of time hence hurried back to fire. They ferry over this Lethean sound, this is the sound over the river Lethe, line 605, both to and fro their sorrow to augment, and wish to struggle as they pass to reach the tempting stream, with one small drop to lose in sweet forgetfulness all pain and woe, all in one moment and so near the brink. But fate withstands, and to oppose the attempt, Medusa with Gorgonian terror guards the ford. All right. They dream of being able to get to the river Lethe and drink a little bit so that they can forget the torments they are under. However, there are Medusa with Gorgonian terror guards. The Medusa was a Gorgon. That's the very ugly woman with snakes for a hair. And there are Gorgons who stand guard by the river of forgetfulness. Medusa with Gorgonian terror guards the ford, and of itself the water flies all taste of living white, as once it fled the lip of Tantalus. Tantalus is the one I mentioned earlier who tries to drink and it retreats from him. Thus roving on in confused march forlorn, the adventurous bands, line 615, with shuddering horror pale, and eyes aghast, viewed first their lamentable lot, and found no rest, through many a dark and dreary vale they passed, and many a region dolorous, o'er many a frozen, many a fiery alp, rocks, caves, lakes, fens, bogs, dens, and shades of death, a universe of death, which God by curse created evil, for evil only good, where all life dies, death lives, and nature breeds, perverse, all monstrous, all prodigious things, line 625. Abominable, inutterable, and worse than fables yet have feigned, or fear conceived, Gorgons and Hydras and Chimeras dire. Meanwhile, the adversary of God and man, line 629, this of course is Satan, and we are going back in the story. Meanwhile, Satan, remember, has gone to explore and spy on earth. Meanwhile, the adversary of God and man, Satan, with thoughts inflamed of highest design, puts on swift wings, and towards the gates of hell explores his solitary flight. Sometimes he scours the right-hand coast, sometimes the left, now shaves with level wing the deep, then soars up to the fiery concave, towering high, line 635, and a Homeric simile. As when far off at sea a fleet descried hangs on the clouds by equinoctial winds, close sailing from Bengala or the isles of Ternate and Tidore, whence merchants bring their spicy drugs, they on the trading flood, through the wide Ethiopian to the Cape Ply, stemmingly nightly toward the pole, so seemed far off the flying fiend, at last appear hell-bound's high-reaching to the horrid roof, and thrice threefold the gates. Three folds were brass, line 645. Three iron, three of adamantine, this is diamond, rock, impenetrable, impalled with circling fire, yet unconsumed. Before the gates there sat on either side a formidable shape. The one seemed woman to the waist and fair, this is line 650, but ended foul in many a scaly fold, voluminous and vast, a serpent armed with mortal sting. All right, here's a female, something that looks like a woman above and a serpent below and around her, and she has a mortal sting. About her middle round a cry of hellhounds, never ceasing barked with wide Cerberian mouths. Cerberus was the three-headed dog that guarded the underworld, with wide Cerberian mouths, full loud and rung, line 655, and rung a hideous peal, yet, when they list, would creep, if aught disturbed their noise, into her womb and kennel there, yet there still barked and howled within, unseen. Far less abhorred than these, vexed Scella, bathing in the sea that parts Calabria from the hoarse Trinacrian shore, nor uglier follow the night hag, when call in secret, riding through the air she comes, lured with the smell of infant blood, to dance with Lapland witches, while the laboring moon eclipses at their charms. The other shape, if shape it might be called, that shape had none distinguishable in member, joint, or limb, or substances might be called, that shadow, which is death, seemed, for each seemed either, black it stood as night, line 670, fierce as 10 furies, terrible as hell, and shook a dreadful dart, what seemed his head, the likeness of a kingly crown had on. Satan was now at hand, and from his seat the monster moving onward came as fast with horrid strides. Hell trembled as he strode. The undaunted fiend, this is Satan, what this might be admired, not feared, God and his son except, created thing not valued, nor he shunned. Satan admires created evil beings. The only thing he fears is God and his son. Line 680. And with disdainful look thus first began. So Satan now speaks to the gatekeeper. Whence and what art thou, execrable shape, that darest, through grim and terrible, advance thy miscreated front athwart my way to yonder gates? Through them I mean to pass. Retire, or taste thy folly, and learn by proof, hell-born, not to contend with spirits of heaven. So Satan is here demanding respect of death, because death was hell-born, and because he, Satan, was born in heaven. So he's looking for a little bit of respect here. To whom the goblin, full of wrath, replied, Art thou that traitor angel? Art thou he who first broke peace in heaven and faith, till then unbroken, and in proud rebellious arms, drew after him the third part of heaven's sons, conjured against the highest for which both thou and they, outcast from God, are here condemned to waste eternal days in woe and pain? Line 695. And reckonst thou thyself with spirits of heaven, hell-doomed, and breathest defiance here and scorn where I reign king? And to enrage thee more, thy king and lord, to make you more mad, I am your king and lord, because I reign king here. Back to thy punishment, false fugitive, and to thy speed add wings, lest with a whip of scorpions I pursue thy lingering, and with one stroke of this dart strange horror seize thee, and pains unfelt before. So spake the grisly terror, and in shape, so speaking and so threatening, grew tenfold more dreadful and deform. On the other side, incensed with indignation, Satan stood unterrified, and, like, and this is of course a simile, like a comet burned that fires the length of Ophiuchus's huge in the Arctic sky, and from his horrid hair shakes pestilence and war, each at the head leveled his deadly aim. They're having a stare-off. Their fatal hands no second stroke intend, and such a frown each cast at the other as, when two black clouds with heaven's artillery fraught, come rattling on over the Caspian Sea. Then stand front to front, hovering a space, till winds the signal blow to join their dark encounter in mid-air. So frowned the mighty combatants that hell grew darker at their frown. So matched they stood, line 720. For never but once more was either like to meet so great a foe. And now great deeds had been achieved, whereof all hell had rung, had not the snaky sorceress, and of course this is sin, the snaky sorceress, had not the snaky sorceress that sat fast by Hellgate and kept the fatal key, risen and with hideous outcry rushed between. So she's trying to break up the fight. And Sin says, O father, what intends thy hand, she cried, against thy only son? What fury, O son, possess thee to bend that mortal dart against thy father's head? And knowest for whom, for him who sits above and laughs the while at thee ordained his drudge, to execute whatever his wrath, which he calls justice, bids, his wrath, which one day will destroy ye both. That's a bit of prophecy there. She spake, and at her words the hellish pest forbore. Then these to her Satan returned. And so now Satan is going to reply to his daughter Sin. He's trying to figure out who she is. "So strange thy outcry, and thy words so strange thou interposest, that my sudden hand prevented spares to tell thee yet by deeds what it intends. I don't even know what I'm going to do, till first I know of thee. Who are you? What thing thou art, thus double-formed, half woman, half icky thing? And why, in this infernal veil, first met, thou callest me father, and that phantasm callest my son? I know thee not, nor ever saw, till now, sight more detestable than him and thee." Line 745. To whom thus the portress of Hellgate, and that is Sin, replied, "Hast thou forgot me then, and do I seem now in thine eye so foul, once deemed so fair in heaven, when at the assembly and in sight of all the seraphim with thee combined in bold conspiracy against heaven's king, all on a sudden miserable pain surprised thee, dim thine eyes, and dizzy swum in darkness, while thy head flames thick and fast threw forth, till on the left side, opening wide, likest to thee in shape and countenance bright, then shining heavenly fair, a goddess armed, out of thy head I sprung." All right. For those of you familiar with classical gods and goddesses, Athena is the warrior goddess who sprung out of Zeus's head from Zeus alone, fully grown, fully armed. And so metaphorically, that's painting the same picture here. "Amazement seized all the host of heaven. Back they recoiled, afraid at first, and called me Sin. And, for a sign, portentous held me, but familiar grown I pleased, and with attractive graces won the most averse, thee chiefly, who full oft, thyself in me, thy perfect image viewing, becamest enamored." That's line 765. And I'll remind you of James 1:15, in case you don't have this footnote in your edition. James 1:15, "Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death." And Milton's painting a literal picture of that for us. Line 765, "He became enamored, and such joy thou tookest with me in secret, that my womb conceived a growing burden." So she's reminding him he had lusted after her, and she had conceived. "Meanwhile, war arose, and fields were fought in heaven, wherein remained, for what could else, to our almighty foe clear victory. To our part loss and rout through all the empyrean. Down they fell, driven headlong from the pitch of heaven, down into this deep. And in the general fall, I also, at which time this powerful key," all right, she's got the key, "into my hand was given, with charge to keep these gates forever shut, which none can pass without my opening. Pensive here I sat alone, but long I sat not, till my womb, pregnant by thee, and now excessive grown, prodigious motion felt and ruleful throes." Line 780. "At last, this odious offspring whom thou seest, thine own begotten, breaking violent way, tore through my entrails, that with fear and pain distorted all my nether, my lower, shape thus grew transformed. But he, my inbred enemy," so this child is also her enemy, "forth issued, brandishing his fatal dart made to destroy. I fled and cried out, Death! Hell trembled at the hideous name, and sighed from all her caves, and back resounded, Death. I fled, but he pursued, though more it seems inflamed with lust than rage, and swifter far me overtook his mother all dismayed, and in embraces forcible and foul engendering with me, of that rape begot these yelling monsters that with ceaseless cry surround me, as thou sawest, hourly conceived and hourly born, with sorrow infinite to me, for when they list into the womb that bred them, they return and howl and gnaw my bowels, their repast, their snack. Then bursting forth," line 800, "afresh with conscious terrors vex me round, that rest or intermission none I find. Before mine eyes in opposition sits grim death, my son and foe, who sets them on, and me his parent would full soon devour for want of other prey, but that he knows his end with mine involved, and knows that I should prove a bitter morsel, and his bane," or a bane is a poison or curse. And so her son would eat her, except he knows that it would be death to him.
whenever that shall be, so fate pronounced. But thou, O father, line 810, I forewarn thee, shun his deadly arrow, neither vainly hope to be invulnerable in those bright arms, though tempered heavenly, for that mortal dint, save he who reigns above, none can resist. So she's telling him, beware of your son, that poison dart is pretty wicked. Line 815. She finished, and the subtle fiend, Satan, his lore soon learned, now milder, and thus answered smooth, dear daughter, this is Satan speaking to sin, dear daughter, since thou claim'st me for thy sire, and my fair son here showest me the dear pledge of dalliance had with thee in heaven, and joys then sweet, now sad to mention, through dire change befallen us unforeseen, unthought of, I come no enemy, but to set free from out this dark and dismal house of pain, both him and thee, and all the heavenly host of spirits that in our just pretenses armed fell with us from on high. From them I go, this uncouth errand, soul, I'm going alone, and one for all myself expose, with lonely steps to tread. All right, for Milton's readers, he's actually recalling the path that Christ will take. He takes an errand no one else would do, but to expose himself, the lonely steps, and so Satan is trying to ennoble himself here. Myself expose with lonely steps to tread the unfounded deep, and through the void immense to search with wandering quest a place foretold, line 830, a place foretold should be, and, by concurring signs, ere now created vast and round, a place of bliss in the purlieus of heaven, and therein placed a race of upstart creatures, to supply perhaps our vacant room, though more removed, lest heaven surcharged with potent multitude might hap to move new broils, be this or aught, than this more secret now designed, I haste to know, and this once known shall soon return, and bring ye to the place where thou in death shall dwell at ease. So he's saying that this lonely mission he's going on is to prepare a place for sin and death. So that you and thou and death shall dwell at ease, and up and down unseen, wing silently the buxom air, embalmed with odors. There ye shall be fed and filled immeasurably. All things shall be your prey. He ceased, for both seemed highly pleased, and death, line 845, grinned horrible, a ghastly smile, to hear his famine should be filled, the always hungry one, and blessed his maw, his mother, destined to that good hour, no less rejoiced his mother bad, and thus bespake her sire. And so sin is now speaking to her sire, her father, Satan. Line 830. The key of this infernal pit by due and by command of heaven's all-powerful king I keep, by him forbidden to unlock these adamantine gates. Against all force, death ready stands to interpose his dart, fearless to be o'ermatched by living might, line 855. But what owe I to his commands above, who hates me, and hath hither thrust me down into this gloom of Tartarus profound, to sit in hateful office here confined, inhabitant of heaven and heavenly born, here in perpetual agony and pain? And so she's saying here, she owes her allegiance to her father more than she does to God. With terrors and clamors compassed around of mine own brood, that on my bowels feed, thou art my father, thou my author, thou my being gavest me. Whom should I obey but thee, whom follow? Thou wilt bring me soon to that new world of light and bliss, among the gods who live at ease, where I shall reign at thy right hand voluptuous, as beseems thy daughter and thy darling without end. Line 870. And now she's going to unlock the door. Thus saying, from her side the fatal key, sad instrument of all our woe, she took, and towards the gate rolling her bestial train, forthwith the huge portcullis high updrew, which but herself not all the Stygian powers could once have moved. Then in the keyhole turns the intricate wards, and every bolt and bar of massy iron or solid rock with ease unfastens. On a sudden, open fly with impetuous recoil and jarring sound, line 880, the infernal doors, and on their hinges great harsh thunder, that the lowest bottom shook of Erebus. She opened, but to shut excelled her power. So sin can only open the gates of hell. She cannot close them.
The gates wide open stood, that with extended wings, line 885, a bannered host under spread ensigns, these are under flags, marching might pass through with horse and chariots ranked in loose array, so it's open very wide. So wide they stood, and like a furnace mouth cast forth redounding smoke and ruddy flame, before their eyes in sudden view appear the secrets of the hoary deep, a dark, illimitable ocean without bound, without dimension, where length, breadth, and height, and time and place are lost, where eldest night and chaos, ancestors of nature, hold eternal anarchy amidst the noise of endless wars and by confusion stand. For hot, cold, moist, and dry, four champions fierce strive here for mastery. These are the four elements striving for mastery. And to battle bring their embryon, embryon is like an embryo, their embryon atoms. They around the flag of each his faction, in their several clans, light-armed or heavy, sharp, smooth, swift or slow, swarm populous, unnumbered as the sands of bark or sirens toward soil, levied to side with warring winds and poise, line 905, their lighter wings. To whom these most adhere, he rules a moment. Chaos umpire sits, and by decision more embroils the fray by which he reigns. Next him, high arbiter, chance governs all. Into this wild abyss, the womb of nature, and perhaps her grave, of neither sea, nor shore, nor air, nor fire, but all these in their pregnant causes, mixed confusedly, and which thus must ever fight, unless the Almighty Maker them ordain his dark materials to create more worlds. Into this wild abyss, the wary fiend, this is Satan, stood on the brink of hell and looked a while. All right, he's standing on the brink of hell and looking out into this vast abyss and wondering, he's realizing just how far away he is from anything familiar. Stood on the brink of hell and looked a while, pondering his voyage, for no narrow frith he had to cross. This is a litote, an understatement. For no narrow frith he had to cross. Nor was his ear less peeled, line 920, with noises loud and ruinous, to compare great things with small, than well when Bellona, the goddess of war, storms, with all her battering engines bent to raise some capital city, or less than if this frame of heaven were falling, and these elements, in mutiny, had from her axle torn the steadfast earth. At last his sail-broad vans, his sails, in other words, his wings, he spreads for flight, and in the surging smoke uplifted, spurns the ground. All right, so Satan's taking off. Hence many a league, and here we have a Homeric simile, as in a cloudy chair ascending rides audacious, but that seat soon failing meets a vast vacuity, all unawares, okay, just like when a cloudy chair rides up and realizes there's nothing there and meets the great vacuum, all unaware, fluttering his pennons, his useless wings, vain, plumb down, he drops 10,000 fathom deep, and to this hour down had been falling, had not by ill chance the strong rebuff of some tumultuous cloud, instinct with fire and nitre, hurried him as many miles aloft. All right, so he takes off and finds that when he leaves hell, he cannot fly. That fury stayed, quenched in a boggy Syrtis. Remember, in Book 1, line 225, we know he's able to fly. Neither sea nor good dry land, nigh foundered on he fares, line 940. Treading the crude consistence, half on foot, half flying, behooves him now both oar and sail, as when a griffin, the griffin is that creature that is mythical, half eagle, half lion, as when a griffin through the wilderness with winged course, o'er hill or moory dale, pursues the Arimisbian who by stealth had from his wakeful custody purloined the guarded gold. So eagerly the fiend, Satan, o'er bog or steep, through strait, rough, dense or rare, with head, hands, wings, or feet, pursues his way, and swims or sinks or wades or creeps or flies, line 950. At length, a universal hubbub wild of stunning sounds and voices all confused, borne through the hollow dark, assaults his ears with loudest vehemence.
Thither he plies, undaunted, to meet there whatever power or spirit of the northernmost abyss might in that noise reside, of whom to ask which way the nearest coast of darkness lies, bordering on light, when straight, behold the throne of chaos, line 960. And his dark pavilion spread wide on the wasteful deep. With him enthroned sat sable-vested Night, eldest of things. These are classical anthropomorphisms, Night as a goddess, Chaos as a goddess, the consort of his reign. And by them stood Orcus, this is Hades, and Aedes, and the dreaded name of Demogorgon. Rumor next, and chance, and tumult, and confusion all embroiled, and discord with a thousand various mouths. Now Satan will speak. To whom Satan, turning boldly thus, Ye powers and spirits of this nethermost abyss, chaos, and ancient night, I come no spy, line 970, with purpose to explore or to disturb the secrets of your realm, but by constraint, wandering this darksome desert, as my way lies through your spacious empire up to light, alone and without guide, half lost, I seek what readiest path leads where your gloomy bounds confine with heaven. All right, he's looking for the outskirts of heaven. Or, if some other place from your dominion won, the ethereal king possesses lately, thither to arrive I travel this profound. Direct my course, line 980. Directed, no mean recompense it brings to your behoof, if I that region lost, all usurpation hence expelled, reduced to her original darkness and your sway, which is my present journey, and once more erect the standard there of ancient night. Already he's going to do them both a favor. Yours be the advantage all, mine the revenge. Thus Satan, and him thus the anarch old, with faltering speech and visage incomposed, answered. So Chaos is now speaking to Satan. I know thee, stranger, who thou art, line 990, that mighty leading angel who of late made head against heaven's king, though overthrown. I saw and heard, for such a numerous host fled not in silence. This is another leetote, an understatement for the purpose of making a point. For such a numerous host fled not in silence, through the frighted deep, with ruin upon ruin, rout on rout, line 995. Confusion worse confounded, and heaven's gates poured out by millions her victorious bands pursuing. I upon my frontiers here keep residence, if all I can will serve, that little which is left so to defend, encroached on still through our intestine broils, weakening the scepter of old night. First hell, your dungeon, stretching far and wide beneath, now lately heaven and earth, another world hung o'er my realm, linked in a golden chain. This is that great chain of being that was supposed to have been let down by heaven. Milton kind of equated that with Jacob's ladder. It's somewhat of a connection with the heavens, line 1005. Linked to a golden chain, to that side, heaven, from whence your legions fell. You may have a footnote about the golden chain in your book. You might want to look that one up in the book back. It would be very interesting. If that be your walk, you have not far, so much the nearer danger. Go and speed. Havoc and spoil and ruin are my gain. Line 1010. He ceased, and Satan stayed not to reply, but glad that now his sea should find a shore, with fresh alacrity and force renewed, springs upward like a pyramid of fire into the wild expanse, and through the shock of fighting elements, on all sides round, environed, winds his way, harder beset and more endangered than when Argo passed through Bosporus betwixt the jostling rocks. Argus is the creature with 100 eyes. Or when Ulysses, this is Odysseus, on the larboard shunned Charybdis, and by the other whirlpool steered. So he with difficulty and labor hard moved on, with difficulty and labor he, but he once passed soon after when man fell, strange alteration. Sin and death amain following his track, such was the will of heaven. 1025. Paved after him a broad and beaten way over the dark abyss, whose boiling gulf tamely endured a bridge of wondrous length, from hell continued reaching the utmost orb of this frail world, by which the spirits perverse with easy intercourse pass to and fro, to tempt or punish mortals, except whom God and good angels guard by special grace. But now at last the sacred influence of light appears, and from the walls of heaven, line 1035, shoots far into the bosom of dim night, a glimmering dawn. Here nature first begins her farthest verge, and chaos to retire as from her outmost works, a broken foe, with tumult less and with less hostile din, that Satan with less toil and now with ease wafts on the calmer wave by dubious light, and like a weather-beaten vessel holds gladly the port, though shrouds and tackle torn, or in the emptier waste, resembling air, waves his spread wings, at leisure to behold far off the imperial heaven, extended wide in circuit, undetermined square or round, with opal towers and battlements adorned of living sapphire, once his native seat. Line 1050. And fast by, hanging in a golden chain, this pendant world, in bigness as a star, of smallest magnitude, close by the moon. That's our world, the earth, hanging from this chain. Thither full fraught with mischievous revenge, accursed and in a cursed hour, he hies, which means he hurries. Line 1055, end of book 2. That be assured, without leave asked of thee. Line 685.